Grab your stuff. Beck just walked in, and he's in bad shape. Struck dumb by Beck's miraculous resurrection, an exhausted Hutchison crawled outside to answer the call. He, Athens, and Burleson placed Beck in an unoccupied tent, bundled him into two sleeping bags with several hot water bottles, and put an oxygen mask over his face. At that point, Hutchison confesses, none of us thought Beck was going to survive the night. I could barely detect his carotid pulse, which is the last pulse you lose before you die. He was critically ill, and even if he did live until morning, I couldn't imagine how we were going to get him down. By now, the three Sherpas who had gone up to rescue Scott Fisher and Makalu Gao were back in camp after bringing down Gao. They'd left Fisher on a ledge at 27,200 feet after concluding that he was beyond saving. Having just seen Beck walk into camp after being given up for dead, however, Anatoly Bukharev was unwilling to write Fisher off. At 5 p.m., as the storm intensified, the Russian headed up alone to attempt to save him. I find Scott at 7 o'clock. Maybe it is 7:30 or 8, says Bukharev. By then it is dark. Storm is very strong. His oxygen mask is around face, but bottle is empty. He's not wearing mittens, hands completely bare. Down suit is unzipped, pulled off shoulder. One arm is outside clothing. There is nothing I can do. Scott is dead. With a heavy heart, Bukharev lashed Fisher's backpack across his face as a shroud and left him on the ledge where he lay. Then he collected Scott's camera, ice axe, and favorite pocket knife, which Beidelman would later give to Scott's 9-year-old son in Seattle, and descended into the tempest. The gale that struck on Saturday evening was even more powerful than the one that had lashed the call the night before. By the time Bukharev made it back down to Camp 4, the visibility was down to a few yards, and he almost failed to find the tents. Breathing bottled oxygen, thanks to the IMAX team, for the first time in 30 hours, I fell into a tortured, fitful sleep despite the racket produced by the furiously flapping tent. Shortly after midnight, I was in the midst of a nightmare about Andy. He was falling down the Lhotse face trailing a rope, demanding to know why I hadn't held on to the other end, when Hutchison shook me awake. John, he shouted above the roar of the storm, I'm concerned about the tent. Do you think it's going to be okay? As I struggled groggily up from the depths of my troubled reverie, like a drowning man rising to the ocean's surface, it took me a minute to notice why Stuart was so worried. The wind had flattened half our shelter, which rocked violently with each successive gust. Several of the poles were badly bent, and my headlamp revealed that two of the main seams were in imminent danger of being ripped asunder. Flurries of fine snow particles filled the air inside the tent, blanketing everything with frost. The wind was blowing harder than anything I'd ever experienced anywhere, even on the Patagonian ice cap, a place reputed to be the windiest on the planet. If the tent disintegrated before morning, we would be in grave trouble. Stuart and I gathered up our boots and all our clothing and then positioned ourselves on the windward side of the shelter, bracing our backs and shoulders against the damaged poles. For the next 3 hours, we leaned into the hurricane despite our surpassing fatigue, holding up the battered nylon dome as if our lives depended on it. I kept imagining Rob up on the south summit at 28,700 feet, his oxygen gone, exposed to the full savagery of this storm, with no shelter whatsoever. But it was so disturbing that I tried not to think about it. Just before dawn, on Sunday, May 12th, Stuart's oxygen ran out. Without it, I could feel myself becoming really cold and hypothermic, he says. I began to lose feeling in my hands and feet. I worried that I was slipping over the edge, that I might not be able to get down from the call. And I worried that if I didn't get down that morning, I might never get down. Giving Stuart my oxygen bottle, I rooted around until I found another one with some gas left in it, and then we both began packing for the descent. When I ventured outside, I saw that at least one of the unoccupied tents had blown completely off the call. Then I noticed Ang Dorje, standing alone in the appalling wind, sobbing inconsolably over the loss of Rob. After the expedition, when I told his Canadian friend Marion Boyd about his grief, she explained that Andorji sees his role on this earth as keeping people safe. He and I have talked about it a lot. It's all important for him in terms of his religion and preparing for the next go-around in life. Note: devout Buddhists believe in sonam, an accounting of righteous deeds that, when large enough, enables one to escape the cycle of birth and rebirth and transcend forever this world of pain and suffering. End of note. Even though Rob was the expedition leader, Ang Dorje would see it as his responsibility to ensure the safety of Rob and Doug Hansen and the others. So when they died, he couldn't help but blame himself. Worried that Ang Dorje was so distraught that he might refuse to go down, Hutchison beseeched him to descend from the call immediately. Then, at 8:30 a.m., believing that by now Rob, Andy, Doug, Scott, Yasko, and Beck were all surely dead, a badly frostbitten Mike Groom forced himself out of his tent, gamely assembled Hutchison, Tasky, Fishbeck, and Kosciuszko, and started leading them down the mountain. In the absence of any other guides, I volunteered to fill that role and bring up the rear. As our despondent group filed slowly away from Camp 4 toward the Geneva Spur, I braced myself to make one last visit to Beck, whom I assumed had died in the night. I located his tent, which had been blasted flat by the hurricane, and saw that both doors were wide open. When I peered inside, however, I was shocked to discover that Beck was still alive. He was lying on his back across the floor of the collapsed shelter, shivering convulsively. His face was hideously swollen. Splotches of deep, ink-black frostbite covered his nose and cheeks. The storm had blown both sleeping bags from his body, leaving him exposed to the sub-zero wind, and with his frozen hands, he'd been powerless to pull the bags back over himself or zip the tent closed. "Jesus fucking Christ!" he wailed when he saw me, his features twisted into a rictus of agony and desperation. "What's a guy have to do to get a little help around here?" He'd been screaming for help for 2 or 3 hours, but the storm had smothered his cries. Beck had awakened in the middle of the night to find that the storm had collapsed the tent and was blowing it apart. The wind was pressing the tent wall so hard against my face that I couldn't breathe. It would let up for a second, then come slamming back down into my face and chest, knocking the wind out of me. On top of everything else, my right arm was swelling up, and I had this stupid wristwatch on, so as my arm got bigger and bigger, the watch got tighter and tighter, until it was cutting off most of the blood supply to my hand. But with my hands messed up so badly, there was no way I could get the damn thing off. I yelled for help, but nobody came. It was one hell of a long night. "Man, I was glad to see your face when you stuck your head inside the door." Upon first finding Beck in the tent, I was so shocked by his hideous condition and by the unforgivable way that we'd let him down yet again, I nearly broke into tears. "Everything's gonna be okay," I lied, choking back my sobs as I pulled the sleeping bags over him, zipped the tent door shut, and tried to re-erect the damaged shelter. "Don't worry, pal. Everything's under control now." As soon as I made Beck as comfortable as possible, I got on the radio to Dr. McKenzie at base camp. "Caroline," I begged in a hysterical voice, "what should I do about Beck? He's still alive, but I don't think he can survive much longer. He's in really bad shape." "Try to remain calm, John," she replied. "You need to go down with Mike and the rest of the group. Where are Pete and Todd? Ask them to look after Beck, then start down." Frantic, I roused Athens and Burleson, who immediately rushed over to Beck's tent with a canteen of hot tea. As I hurried out of camp to rejoin my teammates, Athens was getting ready to inject 4 milligrams of dexamethasone into the dying Texan's thigh. These were praiseworthy gestures, but it was hard to imagine that they would do him much good. Chapter 20. The Geneva Spur. 9:45 a.m., May 12th, 1996. 25,900 feet. The one great advantage which inexperience confers on the would-be mountaineer is that he is not bogged down by tradition or precedents. To him, all things appear simple, and he chooses straightforward solutions to the problems he faces. Often, of course, it defeats the success he is seeking, and sometimes it has tragic results. But the man himself doesn't know this when he sets out on his adventure. Maurice Wilson, Earl Denman, Clavs Becker Larsen, none of them knew much about mountain climbing, or they would not have set out on their hopeless quests. Yet untrammeled by techniques, determination carried them a long way. Walt Unsworth, Everest. Yet untrammeled by techniques, determination carried them a long way. Walt Unsworth, Everest. 15 minutes after leaving the South Col on Sunday morning, May 12th, I caught up to my teammates as they were descending from the crest of the Geneva Spur. It was a pathetic sight. We were all so debilitated that it took the group an incredibly long time just to descend the few hundred feet to the snow slope immediately below. The most wrenching thing, however, was our shrunken size. 3 days earlier, when we had ascended this terrain, we'd numbered 11. Now there were only 6 of us. Stuart Hutchison, at the back of the pack, was still atop the spur when I reached him, preparing to rappel down the fixed lines. I noticed that he wasn't wearing his goggles. Even though it was a cloudy day, the vicious ultraviolet radiation at this altitude would render him snowblind very quickly. "Stuart!" I yelled over the wind, pointing at my eyes. "Your goggles!" "Oh, yeah," he replied in a weary voice. "Thanks for reminding me. Hey, as long as you're here, would you mind checking my harness? I'm so tired that I'm not thinking clearly anymore. I'd appreciate it if you'd keep an eye on me." Examining his harness, I saw immediately that the buckle was only half fastened. Had he clipped into the rope with his safety tether, it would have opened under his body weight and sent him tumbling down the Lhotse face. When I pointed this out, he said, "Yeah, that's what I thought, but my hands were too cold to do it right." Yanking off my gloves in the bitter wind, I hurriedly cinched the harness tightly around his waist and sent him down the spur after the others. As he clipped his safety tether onto the fixed rope, he tossed his ice axe down, then left it lying on the rocks as he embarked on the first rappel. "Stuart!" I shouted. "Your axe!" "I'm too tired to carry it," he shouted back. "Just leave it there." I was so knackered myself that I didn't argue with him. I left the axe where it lay, clipped the rope, and followed Stuart down the steep flank of the Geneva Spur. An hour later, we arrived atop the yellow band, and a bottleneck ensued as each climber cautiously descended the vertical limestone cliff. As I waited at the back of the queue, several of Scott Fisher's Sherpas caught up to us. Lobsang Jangbu, half-crazed with grief and exhaustion, was among them. Placing a hand on his shoulder, I told him that I was sorry about Scott. Lobsang pounded his chest and tearfully blurted, "I am very bad luck. Very bad luck. Scott is dead. It is my fault. I am very bad luck. It is my fault. I am very bad luck." I dragged my haggard ass into Camp 2 around 1:30 p.m. Although by any rational standard I was still at high altitude, 21,300 feet, this place felt manifestly different from the South Col. The murderous wind had completely abated. Instead of shivering and worrying about frostbite, I was now sweating heavily beneath a scorching sun. No longer did it seem as though I were clinging to survival by a fraying thread. Our mess tent, I saw, had been transformed into a makeshift field hospital, staffed by Henrik Jessen Hansen, a Danish physician on Mal Duff's team, and Ken Comler, an American client and physician on Todd Burleson's expedition. At 3 p.m., as I was drinking a cup of tea, 6 Sherpas hustled a dazed-looking Makalu Gao into the tent, and the doctors sprang into action. They immediately laid him down, removed his clothing, and stuck an IV tube into his arm. examining his frozen hands and feet, which had a dull, whitish sheen, like a dirty bathroom sink, Kammler observed grimly, "This is the worst frostbite I've ever seen." When he asked Gao if he could photograph his limbs for the medical record, the Taiwanese climber consented with a broad smile. Like a soldier displaying battle wounds, he seemed almost proud of the gruesome injuries he'd sustained. 90 minutes later, the doctors were still working on Makalu when David Brashear's voice barked over the radio. "We're on our way down with Beck. We'll have him to Camp 2 by dark." A long beat passed before I realized that Brashears wasn't talking about hauling a body off the mountain. He and his companions were bringing Beck down alive. I couldn't believe it. When I'd left him on the South Call 7 hours earlier, I was terrified that he wasn't going to survive through the morning. Given up for dead yet again, Beck had simply refused to succumb. Later I learned from Pete Athens that shortly after he had injected Beck with dexamethasone, the Texan experienced an astonishing recovery. Around 10:30, we got him dressed, put his harness on, and discovered that he was actually able to stand up and walk. We were all pretty amazed. They started descending from the call, with Athens directly in front of Beck, telling him where to place his feet. With Beck draping an arm over Athens' shoulders and Burleson grasping the Texan's climbing harness tightly from behind, they shuffled carefully down the mountain. "At times we had to help him pretty substantially," says Athens, "but really, he moved surprisingly well." At 25,000 feet, arriving above the limestone cliffs of the Yellow Band, they were met by Ed Viesters and Robert Schauer, who efficiently lowered Beck down the steep rock. At Camp 3, they were assisted by Brashears, Jim Williams, Veka Gustafsson, and Araceli Segarra, the 8 healthy climbers who actually brought the severely crippled Beck down the Lhotse face in considerably less time than my teammates and I had managed to descend earlier that morning. When I heard that Beck was on his way down, I made my way to my tent, wearily pulled on my mountaineering boots, and started plodding up to meet the rescue party, expecting to encounter them on the lower reaches of the Lhotse face. Just 20 minutes above Camp 2, however, I was amazed to run into the entire crew. Although he was being assisted with a short rope, Beck was moving under his own power. Brashears and company hustled him down the glacier at such a fast pace that in my own woeful state, I could barely keep up with them. Beck was placed beside Gao in the hospital tent, and the physicians began stripping off his clothing. "My God," Dr. Kammler exclaimed when he saw Beck's right hand. "His frostbite is even worse than Makalu's." 3 hours later, when I crawled into my sleeping bag, the doctors were still gingerly thawing Beck's frozen limbs in a pot of lukewarm water, working by the glow of their headlamps. The next morning, Monday, May 13th, I left the tents at first light and walked 2.5 miles through the deep cleft of the Western Coom to the lip of the icefall. There, acting on instructions radioed up from Guy Cotter at base camp, I scouted for a level area that could serve as a helicopter landing pad. Over the preceding days, Cotter had been doggedly working the satellite phone to arrange a helicopter evacuation from the lower end of the Coom, so that Beck wouldn't have to descend the treacherous ropes and ladders of the icefall, which would have been difficult and very hazardous with such severely injured hands. Helicopters had landed in the Coom previously, in 1973, when an Italian expedition used a pair of them to ferry loads from base camp. It was nevertheless extremely dangerous flying, at the limit of the aircraft's range, and one of the Italian machines had crashed on the glacier. In the 23 years since, nobody had attempted to land above the icefall again. Cotter was persistent, however, and thanks to his efforts, the American embassy persuaded the Nepalese army to attempt a helicopter rescue in the Coom. Around 8 Monday morning, as I searched in vain for an acceptable helipad among the jumbled seracs at the lip of the icefall, Cotter's voice crackled over my radio. "The helicopter's on the way, John." "He should be there any minute. You better find a place for him to land pretty quickly." Hoping to find level terrain higher on the glacier, I promptly ran into Beck being short-roped down the Coom by Athens, Burleson, Gustafson, Brashears, Viesters, and the rest of the IMAX crew. Brashears, who had worked around many helicopters during the course of a long and distinguished film career, immediately found a landing pad bordered by two gaping crevasses at 19,860 feet. I tied a silk kata to a bamboo wand to serve as a wind indicator, while Brashears, using a bottle of red Kool-Aid as dye, marked a giant X in the snow at the center of the landing zone. A few minutes later, Makalu Gao appeared, having been dragged down the glacier on a piece of plastic by a half-dozen Sherpas. A moment after that, we heard the thwack, thwack, thwack of a helicopter's rotors thrashing furiously at the thin air. Piloted by Lieutenant Colonel Madan Khatri Chetri of the Nepalese Army, the olive-drab B-2 Squirrel helicopter, stripped of all unnecessary fuel and equipment, made two passes, but on each occasion aborted at the last moment. On Madan's third attempt, however, he settled the squirrel shakily onto the glacier with its tail hanging over a bottomless crevasse. Keeping the rotors revving at full power, never taking his eyes off the control panel, Madan raised a single finger, indicating that he could take only one passenger. At this altitude, any additional weight might cause him to crash while taking off. Because Gao's frostbitten feet had been thawed at Camp 2, he could no longer walk or even stand. So Brashears, Athens, and I agreed that the Taiwanese climber should be the one to go. "Sorry," I yelled to Beck above the scream of the chopper's turbines. "Maybe he'll be able to make a second flight." Beck nodded philosophically. We hoisted Gao into the rear of the helicopter, and the machine labored tentatively into the air. As soon as Madan's skids lifted from the glacier, he nosed the aircraft forward, dropped like a stone over the lip of the icefall, and disappeared into the shadows. A dense silence now filled the coom. 30 minutes later, we were standing around the landing zone, discussing how to get back down, when a faint thwack, 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 thwack sounded from the valley below. Slowly the noise grew louder and louder, and finally the small green helicopter popped into view. Madan flew a short distance up the coombe before bringing the aircraft around so that its snout pointed downhill. Then, without hesitation, he set the squirrel down once more on the Kool-Aid crosshatch, and Brashears and Athens hustled back aboard. A few seconds later, the helicopter was airborne, flitting past the west shoulder of Everest like a freakish metal dragonfly. An hour later, Beck and Makalu Gao were receiving treatment in a Kathmandu hospital. After the rescue team dispersed, I sat in the snow for a long while by myself, staring at my boots, endeavoring to get a grip on what had happened over the preceding 72 hours. How could things have gone so haywire? How could Andy and Rob and Scott and Doug and Yasko really be dead? But try as I might, no answers were forthcoming. The magnitude of this calamity was so far beyond anything I'd ever imagined that my brain simply shorted out and went dark. Abandoning my hope of comprehending what had transpired, I shouldered my backpack and headed down into the frozen witchery of the icefall, nervous as a cat, for one last trip through the maze of decaying seracs. Chapter 21, The Last Chapter. Everest Base Camp, May 13, 1996, 17,600 feet. I shall inevitably be asked for a word of mature judgment on the expedition of a kind that was impossible when we were all up close to it. On the one hand, Amundsen going straight there, getting there first, and returning without the loss of a single man, and without having put any greater strain on himself and his men than was all in the day's work of polar exploration. On the other hand, our expedition, running appalling risks, performing prodigies of superhuman endurance, achieving immortal renown, commemorated in August cathedral sermons and by public statues, yet reaching the pole only to find our terrible journey superfluous and leaving our best men dead on the ice. To ignore such a contrast would be ridiculous. To write a book without accounting for it, a waste of time. Apsley Cherry Garrard, The Worst Journey in the World, an account of Robert Falcon Scott's doomed 1912 expedition to the South Pole. Arriving at the bottom of the Khumbu Icefall on Monday morning, May 13th, I came down the final slope to find Ong Chering, Guy Cotter, and Caroline McKenzie waiting for me at the edge of the glacier. Guy handed me a beer, Caroline gave me a hug, and the next thing I knew I was sitting on the ice with my face in my hands and tears streaking my cheeks, weeping like I hadn't wept since I was a small boy. Safe now, the crushing strain of the preceding days lifted from my shoulders, I cried for my lost companions. I cried because I was grateful to be alive. I cried because I felt terrible for having survived while others had died. On Tuesday afternoon, Neil Bidelman presided over a memorial service at the Mountain Madness encampment. Lobsang Jangbu's father, Nawang Syakya, an ordained lama, burned juniper incense and chanted Buddhist scripture beneath the metallic gray sky. Neil said a few words, Guy spoke, Anatoly Bukharev mourned the loss of Scott Fisher. I got up and stammered out some memories of Doug Hansen. Pete Schoening tried to raise everyone's spirits by urging us to look forward, not back. But when the service ended and we all dispersed to our tents, a funereal gloom hung over base camp. Early the next morning, a helicopter arrived to evacuate Charlotte Fox and Mike Groom, both of whom had frostbitten feet that needed immediate medical attention. John Taskey, who was a doctor, flew out as well to treat Charlotte and Mike en route. Then, shortly before noon, while Helen Wilton and Guy Cotter stayed behind to oversee the dismantling of the Adventure Consultants' compound, Lou Kosciuszko, Stuart Hutchison, Frank Fishbeck, Caroline, and I walked out of base camp, bound for home. On Thursday, May 16th, we were helicoptered from Faroche to the village of Xiangboche, just above Namche Bazaar. As we walked across the dirt landing strip to await a second flight into Kathmandu, Stuart, Caroline, and I were approached by three ashen-faced Japanese men. The first said that his name was Muneo Nukita. He was an accomplished Himalayan climber who'd twice reached the top of Everest, and then politely explained that he was acting as a guide and an interpreter for the other two, whom he introduced as Yasuko Namba's husband, Kenichi Namba, and her brother. Over the next 45 minutes, they asked many questions, few of which I could answer. By then, Yasuko's death had become headline news across Japan. Indeed, on May 12th, less than 24 hours after she perished on the South Col, a helicopter had touched down in the middle of base camp, and two Japanese journalists had hopped out wearing oxygen masks, accosting the first person they saw, an American climber named Scott Darceny. They had demanded information about Yasuko. Now, 4 days later, Nukita warned us that a similarly predacious swarm of print and television reporters lay in wait for us in Kathmandu. Late that afternoon, we jammed aboard a gigantic Mi-17 helicopter and lifted off through a gap in the clouds. An hour later, the chopper set down at Tribhuvan International Airport, and we stepped out the door into a thicket of microphones and television cameras. As a journalist, I found it edifying to experience things from the other side of the fence. The throng of reporters, mostly Japanese, wanted a neatly scripted version of the calamity, replete with villains and heroes. But the chaos and suffering I'd witnessed were not easily reduced to sound bites. After 20 minutes of grilling on the tarmac, I was rescued by David Shenstead, the consul from the American Embassy, who delivered me to the Garuda Hotel. More difficult interviews followed, by other reporters, and then by a gauntlet of scowling officials at the Ministry of Tourism. Friday evening, wandering through the alleys of Kathmandu's Tom L district, I sought refuge from a deepening depression. I handed a scrawny Nepalese boy a fistful of rupees and received a tiny paper-covered packet in return, emblazoned with a snarling tiger. Unwrapping it back in my hotel room, I crumbled the contents across a leaf of cigarette paper. The pale green buds were sticky with resin and redolent of rotting fruit. I rolled a joint, smoked it down to nothing, rolled a second fatty, and smoked nearly half of that one too, before the room began to spin and I stubbed it out. I lay naked across the bed and listened to the sounds of the night drift through the open window. The jingle of rickshaw bells blended with car horns, the come-ons of street peddlers, a woman's laughter, music from a nearby bar. Flat on my back, too high to move, I closed my eyes and let the glutinous pre-monsoon heat cover me like a balm. I felt as though I were melting into the mattress. A procession of intricately etched pinwheels and big-nosed cartoon figures floated across the backs of my eyelids in neon hues. As I turned my head to the side, my ear brushed against a wet spot. Tears, I realized, were running down my face and soaking the sheets. I felt a gurgling, swelling bubble of hurt and shame roll up my spine from somewhere deep inside. Erupting out of my nose and mouth in a flood of snot, the first sob was followed by another, then another, and another. On May 19th, I flew back to the States, carrying two duffels of Doug Hansen's belongings to return to the people who loved him. At the Seattle airport, I was met by his children, Angie and Jamie, his girlfriend Karen Marie, and other friends and family members. I felt stupid and utterly impotent when confronted by their tears. Breathing thick marine air that carried the scent of a minus tide, I marveled at the fecundity of the Seattle spring, appreciating its damp, mossy charms as never before. Slowly, tentatively, Linda and I began the process of becoming reacquainted. The 25 pounds I'd shed in Nepal came back with a vengeance. The ordinary pleasures of life at home, eating breakfast with my wife, watching the sun go down over Puget Sound, being able to get up in the middle of the night and walk barefoot to a warm bathroom, generated flashes of joy that bordered on rapture. But such moments were tempered by the long penumbra cast by Everest, which seemed to recede little with the passage of time. Stewing over my culpability, I put off calling Andy Harris's partner, Fiona McPherson, and Rob Hall's wife, Jan Arnold, for such a long time that they finally phoned me from New Zealand. When the call came, I was able to say nothing to diminish Fiona's anger or bewilderment. During my conversation with Jan, she spent more time comforting me than vice versa. I'd always known that climbing mountains was a high-risk pursuit. I accepted that danger was an essential component of the game. Without it, climbing would be little different from 100 other trifling diversions. It was titillating to brush up against the enigma of mortality, to steal a glimpse across its forbidden frontier. Climbing was a magnificent activity, I firmly believed, not in spite of the inherent perils, but precisely because of them. Until I visited the Himalaya, however, I'd never actually seen death at close range. Hell, before I went to Everest, I'd never even been to a funeral. Mortality had remained a conveniently hypothetical concept, an idea to ponder in the abstract. Sooner or later, the divestiture of such a privileged innocence was inevitable, but when it finally happened, the shock was magnified by the sheer superfluity of the carnage. All told, Everest killed 12 men and women in the spring of 1996, the worst single-season death toll since climbers first set foot on the peak 75 years ago. Of the 6 climbers on Hall's expedition who reached the summit, only Mike Groom and I made it back down. 4 teammates with whom I'd laughed and vomited and held long, intimate conversations lost their lives. My actions, or failure to act, played a direct role in the death of Andy Harris. And while Yasko Namba lay dying on the South Col, I was a mere 350 yards away, huddled inside a tent, oblivious to her struggle, concerned only with my own safety. The stain this has left on my psyche is not the sort of thing that washes off after a few months of grief and guilt-ridden self-reproach. Eventually, I spoke of my lingering disquietude to Clev Schoening, whose home was not far from mine. Clev said that he, too, felt awful about the loss of so many lives, but unlike me, he had no survivor's guilt. He explained, "Out on the call that night, I used up everything I had trying to save myself and the people with me. By the time we made it back to the tents, I had absolutely nothing left. I'd frostbitten one cornea and was practically blind. I was hypothermic, delirious, and shivering uncontrollably. It was terrible losing Yasko, but I've made peace with myself over it because I know in my heart that there was nothing more I could have done to save her. You shouldn't be so hard on yourself. It was a bad storm. In the condition you were in at the time, what could you have possibly done for her?" "Perhaps nothing," I concurred. "But in contrast to Schoening, I'll never be sure. And the enviable peace of which he speaks eludes me." With so many marginally qualified climbers flocking to Everest these days, a lot of people believe that a tragedy of this magnitude was overdue. But nobody imagined that an expedition led by Rob Hall would be at the center of it. Hall ran the tightest, safest operation on the mountain, bar none. A compulsively methodical man, he had elaborate systems in place that were supposed to prevent such a catastrophe. So what happened? How can it be explained not only to the loved ones left behind, but to a censorious public? Hubris probably had something to do with it. Hall had become so adept at running climbers of all abilities up and down Everest that he got a little cocky, perhaps. He'd bragged on more than one occasion that he could get almost any reasonably fit person to the summit, and his record seemed to support this. He'd also demonstrated a remarkable ability to prevail over adversity. In 1995, for instance, Hall and his guides not only had to cope with Hansen's problems high on the peak, but they also had to deal with the complete collapse of another client named Chantal Mauduit, a celebrated French alpinist who was making her seventh stab at Everest without oxygen. Mauduit passed out stone cold at 28,700 feet and had to be dragged and carried all the way down from the south summit to the south col, like a sack of spuds, as Guy Cotter put it. After everybody came out of that summit attempt alive, Hall may well have thought there was little he couldn't handle. Before this year, however, Hall had had uncommonly good luck with the weather, and it might have skewed his judgment. "Season after season," confirmed David Brashears, who has been on more than a dozen Himalayan expeditions and has himself climbed Everest 3 times, "Rob had brilliant weather on summit day. He'd never been caught by a storm high on the mountain." In fact, the gale of May 10th, though violent, was nothing extraordinary. It was a fairly typical Everest squall. If it had hit 2 hours later, it's likely that nobody would have died. Conversely, if it had arrived even 1 hour earlier, the storm could easily have killed 18 or 20 climbers, me among them. Certainly time had as much to do with the tragedy as the weather, and ignoring the clock can't be passed off as an act of God. Delays at the fixed lines were foreseeable and eminently preventable. Predetermined turnaround times were egregiously ignored. Extending the turnaround times may have been influenced to some degree by the rivalry between Fisher and Hall. Fisher had never guided Everest before 1996. From a business standpoint, there was tremendous pressure on him to be successful. He was exceedingly motivated to get clients to the summit, especially a celebrity client like Sandy Hill Pittman. Likewise, having failed to get anybody to the top in 1995, it would have been bad for Hall's business if he failed again in 1996, especially if Fisher succeeded. Scott had a charismatic personality, and that charisma had been aggressively marketed by Jane Bromet. Fisher was trying very hard to eat Hall's lunch, and Rob knew it. Under the circumstances, the prospect of turning his clients around while his rival's clients were pushing toward the summit may have been sufficiently distasteful to cloud Hall's judgment. It can't be stressed strongly enough, moreover, that Hall, Fisher, and the rest of us were forced to make such critical decisions while severely impaired with hypoxia. In pondering how this disaster could have occurred, it is imperative to remember that lucid thought is all but impossible at 29,000 feet. Wisdom comes easily after the fact. Shocked by the toll in human life, critics have been quick to suggest policies and procedures to ensure that the catastrophes of this season won't be repeated. It has been proposed, for example, that a guide-to-client ratio of 1-to-1 be established as the standard on Everest, i.e., each client would climb with his or her own personal guide and remain roped to that guide at all times. Perhaps the simplest way to reduce future carnage would be to ban bottled oxygen except for emergency medical use. A few reckless souls might perish trying to reach the summit without gas, but the great bulk of marginally competent climbers would be forced to turn back by their own physical limitations before they ascended high enough to get into serious trouble. And a no-gas regulation would have the corollary benefit of automatically reducing trash and crowding because considerably fewer people would attempt Everest if they knew supplemental oxygen was not an option. But guiding Everest is a very loosely regulated business, administered by Byzantine Third World bureaucracies, spectacularly ill-equipped to assess qualifications of guides or clients. Moreover, the two nations that control access to the peak, Nepal and China, are staggeringly poor. Desperate for hard currency, the governments of both countries have a vested interest in issuing as many expensive climbing permits as the market will support, and both are unlikely to enact any policies that significantly limit their revenues. Analyzing what went wrong on Everest is a useful enough enterprise. It might conceivably prevent some deaths down the road. But to believe that dissecting the tragic events of 1996 in minute detail will actually reduce the future death rate in any meaningful way is wishful thinking. The urge to catalog the myriad blunders in order to learn from the mistakes is for the most part an exercise in denial and self-deception. If you can convince yourself that Rob Hall died because he made a string of stupid errors and that you are too clever to repeat those same errors, it makes it easier for you to attempt Everest in the face of some rather compelling evidence that doing so is injudicious. In fact, the murderous outcome of 1996 was in many ways simply business as usual. Although a record number of people died in the spring climbing season on Everest, the 12 fatalities amounted to only 3% of the 398 climbers who ascended higher than base camp, which is actually slightly below the historical fatality rate of 3.3%. Or here's another way to look at it. Between 1921 and May 1996, 144 people died and the peak was climbed some 630 times, a ratio of 1 in 4. Last spring, 12 climbers died and 84 reached the summit, a ratio of 1 in 7. Compared to these historical standards, 1996 was actually a safer than average year. Truth be told, climbing Everest has always been an extraordinarily dangerous undertaking, and doubtless always will be, whether the people involved are Himalayan neophytes being guided up the peak or world-class mountaineers climbing with their peers. It is worth noting that before the mountain claimed the lives of Hall and Fisher, it had already wiped out a whole corps of elite climbers, including Peter Boardman, Joe Tasker, Marty Hoey, Jake Breitenbach, Mick Burke, Michel Parmentier, Roger Marshall, Ray Genet, and George Lee Mallory. In the case of the guided ilk, it rapidly became clear to me in 1996 that few of the clients on the peak, myself included, truly appreciated the gravity of the risks we faced, the thinness of the margin by which human life is sustained above 25,000 feet. Walter Mitties with Everest Dreams need to bear in mind that when things go wrong up in the death zone, and sooner or later they always do, the strongest guides in the world may be powerless to save a client's life. Indeed, as the events of 1996 demonstrated, the strongest guides in the world are sometimes powerless to save even their own lives. 4 of my teammates died, not so much because Rob Hall's systems were faulty, indeed, nobody's were better, but because on Everest it is the nature of systems to break down with a vengeance. In the midst of all the post-mortem ratiocination, it is easy to lose sight of the fact that climbing mountains will never be a safe, predictable, rule-bound enterprise. This is an activity that idealizes risk-taking. The sport's most celebrated figures have always been those who stick their necks out the farthest and manage to get away with it. Climbers, as a species, are simply not distinguished by an excess of prudence. And that holds especially true for Everest climbers. When presented with a chance to reach the planet's highest summit, history shows people are surprisingly quick to abandon good judgment. Eventually, warns Tom Hornbein, 33 years after his ascent of the West Ridge, what happened on Everest this season is certain to happen again. For evidence that few lessons were learned from the mistakes of May 10th, one need look no farther than what happened on Everest in the weeks that immediately followed. On May 17th, 2 days after Hall's team quit base camp, over on the Tibetan side of the mountain, an Austrian named Reinhard Vlasic and a Hungarian teammate, climbing without supplemental oxygen, ascended to the high camp at 27,230 feet on the northeast ridge, where they occupied a tent abandoned by the ill-fated Ladakhi expedition. The following morning, Vlasic complained that he felt ill and then lost consciousness. A Norwegian doctor who happened to be present determined that the Austrian was suffering from both pulmonary and cerebral edema. Although the doctor administered oxygen and medication, by midnight, Vlasic was dead. Meanwhile, over on the Nepalese side of Everest, David Brashear's IMAX expedition regrouped and considered their options. Since $5.5 million had been invested in their film project, they had a big incentive to remain on the mountain and undertake a summit attempt. With Brashear's, Ed Veister's, and Robert Schauer, they were without question the strongest, most competent team on the mountain. And despite giving away half of their supply of oxygen to assist rescuers and climbers in need, they were subsequently able to scrounge enough gas from expeditions leaving the mountain to replace most of what they'd lost. Paula Barton Veister's, Ed's wife, had been monitoring the radio as base camp manager for the IMAX crew when disaster struck on May 10th. A friend of both Hall's and Fisher's, she was devastated. Paula assumed that after such a horrifying tragedy, the IMAX team would automatically fold up their tents and go home. Then she overheard a radio call between Brashear's and another climber, in which the IMAX leader nonchalantly declared that the team intended to take a short break at base camp and then go for the summit. After all that had happened, I couldn't believe they'd really go back up there, Paula admits. When I heard the radio call, I just lost it. She was so upset that she left base camp and walked down to Tengboche for 5 days to collect herself. On Wednesday, May 22nd, the IMAX team arrived on the South Col, in perfect weather, and set out for the top that night. Ed Veister's, who had the starring role in the film, reached the summit at 11 Thursday morning, without using supplemental oxygen. Note, Veister's had previously ascended Everest in 1990 and 1991 without gas. In 1994, he climbed it a third time with Rob Hall. On that ascent, he used bottled oxygen because he was guiding the peak and thought it would be irresponsible to do so without it. End of note. Brashear's arrived 20 minutes later, followed by Araceli Segarra, Robert Schauer, and Jomling Norgay Sherpa, the son of the first ascender, Tenzing Norgay, and the ninth member of the Norgay clan to climb the peak. All told, 16 climbers summited that day, including the Swede who'd ridden his bike to Nepal from Stockholm, Goran Krop, and Ang Rita Sherpa, whose ascent marked his 10th visit to the top of Everest. On the way up, Veister's had climbed past the frozen bodies of Fisher and Hall. Both Jean, Fisher's wife, and Jan, Hall's wife, had asked me to bring some personal effects back for them, Veister's says sheepishly. I knew Scott wore his wedding ring around his neck, and I wanted to bring it down to Jeannie, but I couldn't force myself to go digging around his body. I just didn't have it in me. Instead of collecting any keepsakes, Wiesters sat down next to Fisher during the descent and spent a few minutes alone with him. "Hey, Scott, how you doing?" Ed sadly inquired of his friend. "What happened, man?" On Friday afternoon, May 24th, as the IMAX team was descending from Camp 4 to Camp 2, they encountered what remained of the South African team: Ian Woodall, Kathy O'Dowd, Bruce Harrod, and three Sherpas, at the Yellow Band, on their way to the South Col to make their own summit attempt. "Bruce looked strong. His face looked good," recalls Brashears. "He shook my hand really hard, congratulated us, said he felt great." Half an hour behind him were Ian and Kathy, collapsed over their ice axes, looking like hell, really out of it. "I made a point of spending a little time with them," Brashears continues. "I knew they were very inexperienced, so I said, 'Please be careful. You saw what happened up here earlier this month. Remember that getting to the summit is the easy part. It's getting back down that's hard.'" The South Africans set out for the summit that night. O'Dowd and Woodall left the tents 20 minutes after midnight with Sherpas Pemba Tendi, Ang Dorji, and Jongbu carrying oxygen for them. Note: a reminder. The Sherpa named Ang Dorji on the South African team is not the same person as the Sherpa named Ang Dorji on Rob Hall's team. End of note. Harrod seems to have left camp within minutes of the main group, but he fell farther and farther behind as the ascent dragged on. On Saturday, May 25th, at 9:50 a.m., Woodall called Patrick Conroy, the base camp radio operator, to report that he was on the summit with Pemba and that O'Dowd would be on top in 15 minutes with Ang Dorji and Jongbu. Woodall said that Harrod, who wasn't carrying a radio, was some unknown distance below. Harrod, whom I'd met several times on the mountain, was an amiable 37-year-old of bearish build. Although he had no previous high-altitude experience, he was a competent mountaineer who'd spent 18 months in the frigid wastes of Antarctica working as a geophysicist. He was far and away the most accomplished climber remaining on the South African team. Since 1988, he'd been working hard to make a go of it as a freelance photographer, and he hoped reaching the summit of Everest would give his career a needed boost. When Woodall and O'Dowd were on the summit, as it turned out, Harrod was still far below, struggling up the southeast ridge by himself at a dangerously slow pace. Around 12:30 p.m., he passed Woodall, O'Dowd, and the three Sherpas on their way down. Ang Dorji gave Harrod a radio and described where an oxygen bottle had been stashed for him. Then Harrod continued alone toward the top. He didn't reach the summit until just after 5 p.m., 7 hours after the others, by which time Woodall and O'Dowd were already back in their tent at the South Col. Coincidentally, at the same moment Harrod radioed down to base camp to report that he was on top, his girlfriend, Sue Thompson, happened to call Conroy on the base camp satellite phone from her London home. "When Patrick told me that Bruce was on the summit," Thompson recalls, "I said, 'Fuck, he can't be on the summit this late. It's 5:15. I don't like this.'" A moment later, Conroy patched Thompson's phone call through to Harrod on top of Everest. "Bruce sounded compos mentis," she says. "He was aware that he'd taken a long time to get there, but he sounded as normal as one can speak at that altitude, having taken his oxygen mask off to speak. He didn't even seem particularly breathless." Nevertheless, it had taken Harrod 17 hours to climb from the South Col to the summit. Although there was little wind, clouds now enveloped the upper mountain, and darkness was fast approaching. Completely alone on the roof of the world, extremely fatigued, he must have been out of oxygen or nearly out. "That he was up there that late with nobody else around was crazy," says his former teammate Andy de Klerk. "It's absolutely boggling." Harrod had been up on the South Col from the evening of May 9th through May 12th. He'd felt the ferocity of that storm, heard the desperate radio calls for help, seen Beck Weathers crippled with horrible frostbite. Early on during his ascent of May 25th, Herod climbed right past the corpse of Scott Fisher, and several hours later, at the South Summit, he would have had to step over Rob Hall's lifeless legs. Apparently, the bodies made little impression on Herod, however, for despite his lagging pace and the lateness of the hour, he pressed onward to the top. There was no further radio transmission from Herod after his 5:15 call from the summit. "We sat waiting for him at Camp Ford with the radio on," O'Dowd explained in an interview published in the Johannesburg Mail and Guardian. "We were terribly tired and eventually fell asleep. When I woke up the next morning at about 5 a.m. and he hadn't radioed, I realized we had lost him." Bruce Herod is now presumed dead, the 12th casualty of the season. Epilogue. Seattle, November 29, 1996. 270 feet. Now I dream of the soft touch of women, the songs of birds, the smell of soil crumbling between my fingers, and the brilliant green of plants that I diligently nurture. I am looking for land to buy, and I will sow it with deer and wild pigs and birds and cottonwoods and sycamores and build a pond, and the ducks will come and fish will rise in the early evening light and take the insects into their jaws. There will be paths through the forest, and you and I will lose ourselves in the soft curves and folds of the ground. We will come to the water's edge and lie on the grass, and there will be a small, unobtrusive sign that says, "This is the real world, muchachos, and we are all in it. B. Traven." Charles Bowden, Blood Orchid. Several people who were on Everest last May have told me they've managed to move beyond the tragedy. In mid-November, I received a letter from Lou Kosciuszko in which he wrote, "It took a few months in my case for the positive aspects to begin to develop, but they have. Everest was the worst experience in my life, but that was then. Now is now. I'm focusing on the positive. I learned some important things about life, others, and myself. I feel I now have a clearer perspective on life. I see things today I never saw before." Lou had just returned from spending a weekend with Beck Weathers in Dallas. Following his helicopter evacuation from the Western Coombe, Beck had his right arm amputated halfway below the elbow. All four fingers and the thumb on his left hand were removed. His nose was amputated and reconstructed with tissue from his ear and forehead. Lou mused that visiting Beck was both sad and triumphant. "It hurts to see Beck like this. Rebuilt nose, facial scars, disabled for life, Beck wondering if he can practice medicine again, and the like. But it was also remarkable to see how a man can accept all this and be ready to move on in life. He is conquering this. He will be victorious." Beck had only nice things to say about everyone. Beck doesn't play the blame game. You may not have shared political views with Beck, but you would share my pride in seeing how he has handled this. Somehow, someday, this will net out in a positive way for Beck. I'm heartened that Beck, Lou, and others are apparently able to look at the positive side of the experience, and envious. Perhaps after more time has passed, I, too, will be able to recognize some greater good that's resulted from so much suffering, but right now I can't. As I write these words, half a year has passed since I returned from Nepal, and on any given day during those 6 months, no more than 2 or 3 hours have gone by in which Everest hasn't monopolized my thoughts. Not even in sleep is there respite. Imagery from the climb and its aftermath continues to permeate my dreams. After my article about the expedition was published in the September issue of Outside, the magazine received an unusually large volume of mail about the piece. Much of the correspondence offered support and sympathy for those of us who had returned, but there was also an abundance of scathingly critical letters. For example, a lawyer from Florida admonished, "All I can say is that I agree with Mr. Krakauer when he said, 'My actions or failure to act played a direct role in the death of Andy Harris.' I also agree with him when he says he was a mere 350 yards away, lying inside a tent, doing absolutely nothing. I don't know how he can live with himself. Some of the angriest letters, and by far the most disturbing to read, came from relatives of the deceased.